This morning I have with me the Reverend Willie C. Teague, pastor of the New Zion Baptist Church in Alliance. And I've learned to know Reverend Teague through associations with the black groups in Alliance. He's been active in the NAACP and much interested in the history of the black experience in Alliance. I want to talk with him this morning about how he came here and his experience in working and in his church. Now let's start now with how you came here with your parents, and if you want to relate that again.
Well, my father, whose name is Alan Teague, came to Alliance approximately 1919 and found a job in the American Steel Foundry. He then sent for me and my mother. My mother's name is Rilla. And we settled in Alliance. Arriving one rainy day, we stopped there at the restaurant right there by the station. Then we went on up to Broadway, where my father found a house for us to live in, up on Broadway, 744 East Broadway.
Now, you said that was the old Chase House where you saw
it.
And you were old enough to have a vivid recollection that it was rainy when you came to Alliance.
Yes, I was about 7 years old, mm-hmm. 7 years old. Had just started first grade down there when my parents moved here. Mm-hmm. We went to, after getting here, I enrolled at Senator Street School for about a couple of weeks. My parents moved out on Union Avenue, where the Lawson store is now.
Oh, yes.
That was our home there for a short while. So I went to first grade at Senator Street. I went to first grade at North Park. I went to first grade at North Lincoln. Went to first grade at North Franklin.
Well, that's a record.
So we were moving quite rapidly. Yes. And of course, the moving from Park to Lincoln was because of the overcrowding. Mm-hmm. The class was overcrowded, so they transferred us over there. But that time, my father had began to purchase a house over on Pike Street, where I grew up there.
Mm-hmm. So you went through the Alliance school system then?
Yes, I went first grade from Franklin Street School.
When you were growing up in Alliance, you went to school, did you work, did you have any jobs of any sort that you recall as when you got old enough to be employable?
Well, the first job that I had, I think was about the best job I've had in a long, long time. I was in Franklin School, and I was about 11 or 12, when Mr. Weaver, the then president of the First Federal.
Oh, yes.
And Mr. L.L. Weaver was president there. And, I had gone to the bank for some purpose, I don't know what the reason, and he asked whether I wanted to pass some handbills for him. I said, sure. So he gave me a job of passing bills. I did that quite well until I got too careless with the job. But anyway, I think one reason why I got the job, the schools were saving pennies. All the kids were bringing pennies to the school, mm-hmm. and then these pennies had to be carried to the bank. And I was elected the representative of Franklin School, and I had seven schools that I had to walk from, Franklin, North Lincoln, North Park, and all around. And I took my bags of pennies to the First Federal Bank,
yes.
and I gave them to Mr. Weaver. I think that's how he
I see.
Me. Mm-hmm. And I had quite an experience in carrying the money, and maybe that's why I became, later on, a pretty good track man.
I see.
Kids were after me, I would let them catch me with the money. So.
That's interesting.
Of course, after school, as I grew older, I always was, I called an industrious person, because my father liked to sell. He would sell anything you wanted to buy. He would sell it, no matter what it was. If you want to buy it, he'd sell it to you.
Huh.
And I learned those tricks from him. And so as a result, I began to sell products from house to house, newspapers. And I always had money. Other kids were begging their parents for money. I had mine to buy me clothes, little movies and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you grew up in Alliance and graduated from Alliance High School. You said you were good in track. Were you actually on the track team at Alliance High School?
Yes, I went out for the track team my last year, my last qualifying year, and I ran 100, 220, 440. We only had one major track meet, and that was the Salem Night Relays. Down in Salem Night Relays, I had lost the 100, lost my broad jump, lost the quarter, had one race left, and that was a 220. I figured that I could run better than I was running, so I guess I gave it everything I had, and I broke a record then that had been standing for 10 years in Salem Night Relays. So therefore, which qualified me to go to Ohio State for the state meet. At the state meet, I ran against Jesse Owens.
Is that right?
Jesse Owens set his world's high school 220 record there in Ohio State. And in the qualifying heat, I was third. In the main race, I was fifth. And then Jesse Owens set his world 220 record.
That's real competition. You would have to pick a meet like that, you see. The year before, the year after, you might have done much better.
But then, like today, the high school kids have 14 or 15 or 20 meets. And they have excellent opportunities to improve their starting and their methods and their habits of using. Whereas then, we only had one or two meets the whole season. And I just run for national ability.
Yeah, so I imagine it was doing your own thing pretty much at that time. Well, then you indicated that you cast around a bit for education and found the prices were high, and instead of going west, you went south. You want to relate that experience?
Yes, I had prices were too high for me in this area, and I went to Atlanta. Having very little money in my pocket, I didn't know what school to go to, so I asked the cab, "You take me to the nearest school." So he took me straight on down Mitchell Street to Marsh Brown College. I go into the college and I talk with the president, Mr. Bishop, Mr. Fountain, the bishop's son. And I told him my situation. I had some good letters from the community and letters from my church. He read those, and he told me if I was really interested to write my father and find out what he could pay. And I did. All my father could pay was $10 a month. So the president said, "Well, you can stay. If you want an education, you get every opportunity, and we'll let you work your way through." So he gave me a job working for his father. His father was a bishop, so I worked in the bishop's office, cleaning up his office in the morning before I went to breakfast. And I found a job out in the city, working in Maxine Hat Shop there to help supplement.
Yes.
I always wanted to be a doctor. Unfortunately, I didn't. And when my professors would talk to me about my classes in college, they suggested I take education. So if I don't finish my medical work, I can always teach my science
courses. Fall back on that.
I knew what I wanted. I said, "All I want is a doctor. I don't want anything else." So they set me up with all the science courses that I possibly could take. And I went to the school that whole year, came back, and decided to work in American Steel Foundry a year so that the burden wouldn't be so hard on my parents. I worked the following year in the American Steel Foundry. Went back to college, third year, stayed there a year, back out again, worked in American Steel Foundry another year. So the 3 years of college I've had took me 5 years to get.
Yes.
And in the field of medicine, it was just getting rougher and rougher and rougher because I was forgetting more than I was learning, and I was always back of the students. I just couldn't keep up because I had forgotten the fundamentals.
Yes.
So when things got rather rough, I decided to quit. Well, at the time, I was meeting with several church meetings with a girl who had invited me out to her house for dinner. She was an excellent cook, and is an excellent cook, still is.
Well, they say the way to a man's heart, you know.
And I met my wife through school, and I met her parents, and we married. We had the dean of the college. I don't know whether you're familiar with, acquainted with Dr. Hill.
No.
Charles Healy. Used to be the president of Wilberforce.
I see. Uh-huh. The name is all.
About, I think he died about 12, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to perform the wedding ceremony in the chapel. But that Sunday he had been preaching down in Athens and came back in an automobile accident. He didn't get back. So we got married that following Wednesday at the Dean of the Department of History. He was a minister. So we went over to his house and he and my friend and I got married. We left school that Friday coming home. So I did graduate from college. I had 3 years of college.
Yes. Well, and I suppose in a sense, you say you're not a doctor of the physical man, but of the spiritual man, you have ministered to the soul, and in a sense, that's as rewarding and helpful a ministry.
Of course, always I knew that I should be a minister, because all my feelings, my likings, were towards the ministry. And I had an argument with the Lord. The Lord wanted me to preach. I said, no, Lord. Let me be the doctor. Let me be the man to save his body. Then you get somebody else to save his soul. So, perhaps that's one of the reasons why my doctor's work didn't work out.
I see. Well, it's difficult when you get in that sort of an argument, you know. Usually, it works out that way.
You can't win, though.
No, that's right.
So my people say I've been running from the ministry ever since I was a little boy.
I see. Well, now, when you came back here then, did you start in the ministry right away? Did you have a church?
No. I came home from school in 41. I didn't go into ministry until 59.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So I came, me and my wife, myself, with my parents' people. I did various jobs around the community. From the work, your job at Mansfield. We came back here to Alliance, and I got involved in what I call a grocery project. I had been involved in the Future Outlook League.
I heard that name, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Holly, John Holly in Cleveland, he's died years ago, was the president. We organized a branch here in Alliance, the Alliance Future Outlook League, and the purpose of that group was to find jobs for blacks in the area. At the time, on the corner of Patterson and Franklin was a grocery store, Jesse Ioannidis. He had been there for years and years, and 95% or more of his business were black.
Now he was an Italian, right?
He was an Italian.
Yes.
And we asked him to hire a black clerk. Like janitor, put a girl in there for some purpose, a boy for some purpose at all. That he, I refused. I mean, he definitely refused to do this at all. So we called the group together. And we decided to picket. We put a picket around the store, and about a week, the mayor came down, tried to get us to stop. We would stop. Police came down, felt that we were on our rights, we still picketed. But Jesse wouldn't hire, so we went up to the street, another corner store, Patterson Street Market, and we asked him, we want a black clerk in here. So he saw us picketing the other store, he didn't want one. He said, sure, we will hire. So Eugene Thurman, you might know Eugene Thurman was our first clerk from our efforts, so he worked at the Patterson Street Market. In the meantime, there's some dissatisfaction came in the group. We stopped at picket, and Jesse stayed in his place for about 6 or 8 months afterwards. He moved. When he moved, we received the idea, and I thought of the idea, why picket a white man's store? It's his. He worked for it. He and his children for years. He worked and he built it up. It's his. He should have the right to hire whom he wanted to hire. Mm-hmm. However, I felt otherwise.
Yes.
So I said to the group, let us build a store so we can hire whom we want to hire. And we don't want to hire the white men, but we don't have to because it's ours. So we tried to get a group together. $10 a share, we couldn't get to go. We had about seven people to bring the gym bus. That wasn't at the start.
No.
So a friend of mine says, well, they won't give $10, let's try $100. Mr. Tom Simmons, remember that name?
Yes.
Mr. Tom Simmons was one suggestion. Well, let's give $100. And we passed a list out and got a group of 12 men who said they would give us $100 to start the group with. So Tom and I said, well, if these men are interested, let's tell them all to meet the First National Bank on a certain date with their $100. Whoever arrives, those are the ones we're going to have in the store. So out of the 12 people invited, seven came with their $100. And we went in the bank and planked down $100 in the savings account. But from then on, we got interested in the store. I took this idea of the $10 thing because I felt it was good and sound. And being in the church even at that time, I went to our associations, our general conferences, all of them, and talked to groceries. So I talked to the moderator and gave me a whole session to talk to the group about it. And many of the men in the session signed up to greet the ministers with laymen. So we called a meeting here in Alliance, Hawaii, back in 1944, to organize what we call the Ohio Progressive Association. About 50 people came out, we organized, and it grew. It grew until we got a store here in Alliance, we had a store in Warren, a store in Youngstown, a store in Mansfield.
Now, what kind of store was this?
This is a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
In the city, because it's a Ohio Progressive Association incorporated with the license to have stores all over the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting along fairly well, but the trouble was the inexperience of the manager.
Yeah.
I didn't have the experience
mm-hmm.
actually operating a grocery store. So my forte was books. I would do the books and the history of it and the background of it and motivation, but the actual work, I didn't have the experience. The clerks that were hired by us didn't have the experience. We didn't have any good meat men or vegetable men. We just had an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, there was much trouble and mismanagement.
Yes.
So as a result, it was not successful. So we started closing the stores down. They closed down about, I worked about 20 years in that,
that
grocery field. So perhaps that's one reason why I'm not as well off financially as I ought, as my peers are.
Yes.
But it has been sacrifice and with joy, but the project was a failure.
Well, it's like the saying, the operation of success, the patient died. You know, the idea was a fine one, but the success was not.
We style ourselves like a Kaiser with the small car. So years ago, the small car was good, but it's improper time.
Yes.
If we had the same idea now in groceries, I think we'd make successful.
Yes.
Because we have so many areas to get help.
Right.
The government would help, helping finances, helping bookkeeping, helping structuring the work, but then we had nothing.
Nothing, yes.
No. But I don't regret those years, although they've been rough years.
Yes, they would be. Well, then, this took you up to about what time, you say, about 59?
Up to the late 50s.
The 50s.
And I got a job with Cope Electric Company.
When they were on the square down there.
Next post office.
Yes.
Right
down. Well, not the square. I meant at the corner of Arch and Main there. Yeah.
That's right. I got a job there as a clerk. I worked there until the manager died. And after he died, I became the manager of the warehouse. I worked there about 11 years. They went out of business.
Yes.
And they went out of business. Well, I tried to get a job in that same field, but I couldn't find one. So I was getting hit and miss until I finally found a job for it. Now, I've been here for 12 years, DW Research.
Well, now, in the meantime, then, when did you pick up your position of leadership with the church? And how did this come about?
Well, and I was living in Youngstown at the time when I really got the call, the impelling call. There was no rest and no peace at all, nowhere. And everything I seemed to do was a failure. I just couldn't make any success out of it. I had this urge to preach. I asked my ministers about it, and he said, perhaps that does constitute a call. So I was ordained at the Holy Trinity Baptist Church in Youngstown, Ohio in 59. But I've lived here. I perhaps lived in Youngstown a while and other cities a while, but Alliance has been home.
This is home, yes.
It's been home. So working at Cope Electric during the time, living in Youngstown, I learned that the minister of the New Hope Baptist Church was ill. I went over and asked whether I could assist there. I had permission to assist there. And the minister took a leave of absence to South to recuperate. After this year of leave was up, he decided not to return, and the church elected me the pastor of the church in 61. So I served as pastor of the church there until the merger of the two churches. The other church is Mount Zion, Mount Olive. Mount Zion Baptist Church,
mm-hmm.
The one you were mentioning about.
Yes.
Mount Olive, which Reverend Burris was the pastor.
Oh, yes.
Mount Zion Baptist Church and the New Hope Baptist Church came together in a merger.
Oh.
In 1972.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, the former pastor resigned, which left Mount Zion without a pastor. I was the pastor of the New Hope Baptist mm-hmm. Church. So in the merger, they elected me the pastor of the combined church.
I see.
And that's why we have the New Zion
New
Baptist
Zion
Church.
Baptist. Mm-hmm.
And speaking of mergers, historically, the New Zion Baptist Church is not the first black church merger. The first merger of any black church in Alliance was back in 1930. Back in 1930, the Second Baptist Church merged with the Mount Olive Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. House used to be down on Jersey and down the lower end of Jersey Street. House is torn down now. But that was the first church back in 1930 of any black uh-huh. church in Alliance.
Now, just to digress a moment, how far back historically does your church go? Now, it was a merger of the two churches, but roughly they would have, do you know about the time they would have started here?
Yes, I think I can tell you when these churches started. Okay. Mount Olive Church was started in 1928 by Reverend Jackson in 1928, and during the 1930s it merged with the Second Baptist Church. Now, mm-hmm. Second Baptist Church is the oldest of the Baptist churches in Alliance. It was organized in 1916. Just prior to that, some 6 months prior to Second Baptist organizing, then the St. Luke Church was the first of the organized black churches in the line, mm-hmm. St. Luke AME Churches.
Yeah.
It was a mission church
mm-hmm.
From the United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
The mission was established early 1900s, 1903. It worked as a mission from the Methodist Mission to the Patterson Street AME Zion Church into the St. Luke AME Church up to 1916. So those 2 years it was changing from one place to the other. The Methodists had tried to get the AME Zion to sponsor it, but they didn't have the money, so they went to the African Methodist Episcopal Church for sponsorship.
I see.
And it started in 1916. Of course, they date theirs from 1907 because they take in all the other change, the development of the church.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1907 through 1916, they date their founding church.
Well, now, to go back even farther than that, I came across records in the 1870s when there was an African Methodist here, and then there was a Zion.
How about the Lexington Grove Baptist Church, Holiness Church? Lexington Grove Baptist Church.
I don't.
The one that you talked in the paper about their shouting and the
yes,
loudness.
Yes.
That was with
the settlement of what was known as
yes,
New Guinea. That was that was even earlier. That was earlier. This group that came up. Yes. But an organized, what you would call an organized church. There's evidence in 1870s, and they dedicated a church building here in 1872 or 3. It would be down about where Jay's is, somewhere in that area down there. That was the kind of the outskirts of Alliance at that time. I've written to AME and tried to get some church records, but I evidently they don't have it. I get no reply back. And but then it apparently dropped out of existence, and an organized church doesn't come up until you indicate there about 1907. Well, then, these churches, I suppose, reflected the development of the influx of blacks in the community. There were not enough to support, and sometime after the turn of the century in World War I, there became enough blacks here as your family came up toward the end of the, around 1919, you say. And I suppose many of the black churches were became established from that time on.
Yes, I have the Second Baptist in 1916, the Mount Olive Baptist in 1928, a change in name from the Mount Olive Baptist to the Union Baptist Church in 1930, which finally emerged again with the Second Baptist Church in 1935. Uh-huh. Most of the Baptist churches in Alliance are results of splits.
Mm-hmm.
They're splits. For example, Second Baptist being the oldest of the Baptist Church, split into the Mount Zion Baptist Church into 1934.
Mm-hmm.
Then they in turn split into the Tabernacle Baptist Church. I don't have a year there. Tabernacle Baptist Church in turn split into New Hope Baptist Church in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Then the New Hope Baptist Church and the Mount Zion Baptist Church merges in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
But most of these are results of splits. The splits came about because of difference in the ideologies, principles.
Yes. But this has been the nature of the Protestant tradition, the splits like that. Right.
Of course, we have 11 churches, black churches in Alliance now, with a population, with a total population of 3,000.
Oh, I didn't realize
which
that.
Which makes it difficult
yes,
for church growth.
That's right.
11 black churches with a black population of 3,000, including men, women, and children.
Mm-hmm.
And of these churches, Second Baptist would be considered the larger of all of them. Second Baptist and the Church of God in Christ, and Tabernacle Baptist Church, then the St. Louis Church.
Mm-hmm.
Our church falls about fourth or fifth in
mm-hmm. Your membership would be roughly what?
We have 185 on roll. We have an
yeah,
average attendance of about 90 people
mm-hmm,
in the church.
Yes. And so you have been the pastor of that church since?
1972.
But your association with the church dates from 1959, is that right? Church work?
No, I wouldn't say. As I said previously, always I have been interested in
uh-huh,
church work as a layman.
Yes.
As a layman, I was a member of the Second Baptist Church. I grew up in Second Baptist Church. I was its clerk, general church clerk, when I was 15.
Uh-huh.
I became president of the district work when I was about 16. The district young people work. We had about 10 churches
uh-huh,
under my jurisdiction. Leaving there, I was elected after I came back from, after graduating from high school. I was elected the president of Baptist Training Union work on our convention level. We had about 50 churches there. I was the president over the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we would set up the education department. Many of the churches in the area that had no training department at all in their churches, we were instrumental in getting these training departments set up, which gave me a good background. All this as a layman. Then the height of my layman's work, I guess, was the organizing of the Sunday School and the Baptist Training Union Congress for our convention. Mm-hmm. And after that, then I go to the ministry.
I see.
Which brings up my religious.
Yes.
Always I was interested in religion and the works of the church, even when I was little. The other kids are playing ball, while I'm choir rehearsal, I'm in a meeting here, a meeting mm-hmm. there. My parents didn't have to force me to go to church. I just loved the church. Mm-hmm. Sunday morning, afternoon, night, I could just stay at the church. I only had one instance I might tell about
that.
I was always a hustler, I said, always could find jobs. So evenings after I get out of school, I'd take my father's lawnmower and go all over town. A lawnmower, clippers, see some grass need to be cut, I go to the door, may I cut your grass? And invariably I get the job. So one day my father wanted to cut his grass and the lawnmower was dull. He says, you take the lawnmower to the sharpener, imagine sharpener, you can get it sharpened because I want to cut the grass tomorrow. So the next day, instead of taking it to the lawnmower sharpener, I found a job. I did the job. Came back that evening. My dad said, you get the lawnmower sharpener? I said, no, sir. He said, didn't I tell you the lawnmower sharpener? Yes, sir. He says, okay, you're going to the bathroom and take off your clothes. So I go in the bathroom, takes off my shoes, take off my coat, and my dad comes back with a long switch.
Oh.
With three of them, rather. Three of them wrapped around. I said, he's going to whip me with that? I know I deserve the whip, and I was going to take it. See, but he's going to whip me with those three. So, I had a little dog. The dog followed me to the bathroom. My dad picked the dog up and carried him out. I shut out. And I went to this Monona Baptist Church here. I was a janitor of the church. I goes in, hides in the church. It was about 12 o'clock. And I figured my dad's going to be hiding. My dad would have been running to us. And he'll be hiding someplace. I didn't want to stay there. I said, I'll go up to the Second Baptist Church. I was a janitor there, too.
So oh, yeah.
I goes up to the Second Baptist Church, unlock the door, goes up in the pulpit, and goes to sleep. And the part I want to say, to show you how well acquainted I was with the church, the old Second Baptist, there were two posts on either side of the roster. Nobody knew this but me. And these posts were hollow. I could lift the lid off.
Oh.
They were hollow. But I would steal my mother's peaches and canned goods and carry them. Put them down on the holler here. So every time I got hungry and didn't want to go home, I go to the church.
Oh.
So I stayed all night in church. The next morning, I got my pizzas out of there, ate my pizzas. That evening, I go home. My dad was walking up. He said, you excited to come home? Yes.
Is that right?
But I've always loved the church. I always worked in the church. So my church antecedents did not come exactly from 59. I just dedicated myself for
just sort of a gradual
for a larger
church. Yes. But as a minister, it would be
59.
Yes. Well, now another aspect of the of your growing up here, you talked about a store that was run by an Italian, a grocery store. Would you want to comment? And you indicated about your experience with blacks and. Because they had not had experience, when they did have the opportunity, this made difficulties. Do you want to talk or comment something about black businesses as you think back when you were growing up?
There has always been a very, very few black businesses in Alliance. We say there are perhaps 52 people in business at present time in Alliance. But the older of these would be like Sibley's Funeral Home, or Coleman's Service Station, or George's Service Stations, and one or two of the barbershops. Mm-hmm. These are the older of the businesses. The Blacks in Alliance have never gone for any large types of businesses. Always the early of our businesses were Fish Market, Garner's Fish Market, Mosby's Fish Market, back at the turn of the century. Those are the only type of business. Maybe a confectionery, small confectionery store.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the house next to Beauchamp's now was Jesse's house. That house was down on Patterson and down on Franklin and Reed Street. That's what it was. It was moved. But before it was moved, it was a little building, no larger than this room here. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first confectionery stores that the blacks had. It had a dry cleaning shop on occasion. The beauticians have been rather consistent in their work, but as far as big business is concerned.
Now, what about, the expression today, I guess, is soul food, but, I mean, blacks have always had their type of food and their recipes. Was there any place you could go? Were there any small restaurants or cafes, anything like this? Or was that a part of a club or a lodge where you had this, or maybe a church supper?
Mostly church suppers. Back in the early history, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, there has been no restaurant. Now, on occasion, they have tried to start restaurant. Mm-hmm. Even I've tried to start a restaurant myself. But the type of people we must cater to were not those who went to restaurant. They were those who carried their lunches in the lunch bucket.
Yes.
And they went home for supper.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to influence some blacks to put a restaurant, not for blacks, mm-hmm. but a restaurant in a neighborhood or in a place where there were great conflux of people where they could go. I think a black restaurant, say, on Union Avenue or in the shopping plaza or on Main Street,
mm-hmm.
and cater to good, solid food,
yes,
I think would work. See, but that takes money.
Yes, this is all.
That takes money. And there are a few entrepreneurs in our group. There are few people who have any kind of money that they could develop like that. Until recent, just for the last, say, 10 years, has the Negro's earning power increased enough so that he might now have a little bit more that he could invest in things like this. But prior to the 60s, there was no way for him to do this.
Of course, I suppose if there were a larger black community here, this would be more opportunities.
Yes, like
too.
Pittsburgh, Cleveland.
Yes. What do you estimate is the black community population-wise?
About 3,000.
About 3,000?
About 3,000. Mm-hmm. Men, women, and children.
Yes. And this would be, do you know, roughly, say, when you came here, say 1920, for example, there would be approximately how many? 1,000?
Maybe, yes, 1,000. 1,000. Mm-hmm. When I went to Franklin School, I was many other classes. I was the only black. Because
mm-hmm.
whole Franklin School here was 99% white. When my dad moved over on Pike Street, there were only two other families in the whole area on Pike Street when I moved there.
Now, when you came, this matter of discrimination, which has grown up in recent years, some have told me they didn't notice in earlier years, say at the turn of the century or World War I, there was not this feeling as there has lately been. Can you comment on that?
Well, now it's been polarized, but it's always been there.
Yes.
It has always been there. For example, when I graduated from high school, I wasn't even sure about whether I could go away to college. I couldn't come to Mount. There was a Alliance Business College.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to take some business courses so that perhaps if I wanted to go into business, I would know something about it. I go to the administrator. Sorry, we don't take any blacks here.
Is that right? This would be in the 40s, 30s.
In the 30s?
30s.
I graduated from school in 35.
35.
Mm-hmm. So then they wouldn't take anybody in Alliance Black and Alliance Business College here. I tried to get a job with a Singer sewing machine. They had an ad in the paper. A manager wanted it. Sales manager wanted it. Well, my sales background, I figured I could sell some sewing machines. I wrote them a letter. Then I talked with them on the phone. Talking to me on the phone, you couldn't hardly tell whether I'm black or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so the manager says, yes, we have a job. We'll send our representative down to your house and talk to you. But when he saw me, well, his face turned just as red.
Is that right?
He couldn't hire me. They weren't hiring blacks then. And in the stores, in your grocery stores, all around, there were no blacks in all of the stores. Until through the picket, we were able to get Eugene Thurman at the Patterson Street Market. We were able to get Amelia Cobbs. She's the Cobbs now. She was Amelia Ruffin. Mrs. Ruffin was
the
first girl to work on Main Street. Mm-hmm. She worked at was McCrory's?
Yes. Is it 5 and 10? Was that it?
At the 5 and 10.
Yes.
What's there now? That's Grant's there now, isn't it? What's there
now? Oh, no. I forget what it is. There's just one there now.
At least with the 5 and 10 before this one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't recall, but...
the 5 and 10. Now, she was the first to, mm-hmm. to be hired on Main Street.
Yes.
Of course, my uncle was... I don't know if anyone worked on Main Street before he. My uncle, the one who first came up, Reverend Hosea Tiddens. See, he came up in 1918, and then he would wash windows and clean for Klein and Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
This is way back there.
Mm-hmm. Another integration. How did he happen to come to Alliance? You came through a relative. Now, what brought him here?
Some of his friends.
Some of his friends.
Because he was a minister at the time.
I see.
A minister, and he had an opportunity to preach in Kent, Ohio.
Oh, yes.
And through that, he came to Alliance.
Yes.
And became pastor there in Kent. He lived here in Alliance. So.
So the opportunities were mainly at American Steel, Morgan's, or a plant like this. But other jobs or opportunities were pretty much of a closed proposition.
The first blacks were brought here in numbers by the Morgan Engineering Company. Back during the First War, they would send their representatives to South. And those who wanted to come, one of our members brought in the report the other night that along with this, the Morgan Engineering Company people would give the men a dollar, your spending money, that they would promise to have a house for them and food for them until they got situated. And said many of them who had received the dollar would get off the train and would come. They just took the dollar and went someplace else. But anyway, many of them who came lived in shanties that Morgan Engineering had built. And after the war years were over, these shanties were destroyed, the men were not rehired, and many of them found jobs then at the American Steel Foundry and in the pottery and outlying situations.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the bulk of the blacks came back in the early turn of the century and after the First War, 17 and 18. Maybe that could have been one of the reasons why my uncle came.
Mm-hmm.
His friend came up during this situation.
During that period,
and
yes.
informed him. It could have been.
Yes. And then, I suppose there was what? Was there another wave or group that came in around Depression time? Do you think there was another group?
Yes. Most of these in the 30s came from the Pittsburgh area and the Virginia area.
I see.
From that section up to like Irondale and the places south of Irondale, to that section through this way. Whereas in the earlier years, 1917, 18, the preps that came directly up from Alabama and Mississippi, because there's quite a few. Perhaps the Kirk's family is a good idea, an example of those who arrived, say, from Alabama, Gilbertown, quite a few from Gilbertown, Alabama, Mississippi way, who came up in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
And, then they began to gradually travel in the east direction and then back down.
Mm-hmm. So that this is interesting, the first group came more from the south and the others came from an area closer here. Yeah. Do you have any other comments that you'd like to make? How did you get identified with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People? When did this relationship start, for example?
Well, I've been a card-carrying member for a great number of years in the NAACP.
Well, that's the kind of a card-carrying member to be, you see.
And I learned to love the NAACP from Du Bois.
Oh, yes.
Have you met him? Did you ever know him?
No, I never did. I just read, that's all.
I went to school at Marsh Brown College, and formerly it was all Morehouse College and the Atlanta University system.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Du Bois taught at Atlanta University and from our school. See, but when the school grew, he went directly to Atlanta U. But he had a habit of coming from Atlanta University, up Mitchell, up our steps, walking down our sidewalks to the other part of the city there.
Oh, yeah.
And he's seeing Dr. Du Bois come down the street, we decided we were going to speak to him, but I didn't have a nerve. But my friend said, well, I'll speak to him, so he went down and talked to him. Well, having known Dr. Du Bois and his work with the NAACP and in this stand for black advancement, I learned to love him. And that's how I got first involved in the NAACP. We didn't have one here. So shortly after school, we organized an NAACP branch here in Alliance. We got our charter.
This would be the late 30s?
Yes, in the late 30s, 40s, yeah, we organized it here then. And then I got involved in the grocery business, and that's why I couldn't carry it on. So they got another president, and they worked from there. Now, it has been up and down. It hasn't been going consistent like the last few years. We still have it in existence, but it isn't functioning as it ought to. We do have an active branch now, right now, Mr. Harold Gray is the president. And I'm on the Historical Advisory Committee.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But we've always had an NAACP, and it has had opportunities to settle quite a few problems, although it hasn't come out in the papers that the NAACP has been involved. But remember back in when the library windows were being broken out and the trouble here was in the lines all over the country then, there was that kind of trouble. Well, it did a Herculean work during those days. We had conference after conference in high school, the principal's office, the other schools, talking to the teachers, the principals, day in and day out. And we get the kids on the other end in the New Hope Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. We talk, we plead, we counsel, keep the things down. So fortunately, we were able to do that. It did get out of hand in one or two instances, but not
like it might have been.
Like it was in Watts or other places.
Yes.
Because the kids here, they were angry.
Oh, you bet.
They were angry. And there were many things that the kids couldn't be involved in. Troubles in high school, trouble in the local school, trouble in finding jobs. But the NAACP has had a good involvement in keeping this kind of thing.
In a, what you would call a low-key approach to it. And, of course, when you do that, you can't stand up and take the credit like you. Well, this is interesting facet to know about.
So in some of the bigger cities, so you can make an issue and make a stand for whether you're right or wrong. You've got an issue going.
Yes.
That gives the publicity. We didn't feel that we should do it that way.
Yes.
This is our town. We love our town. We want a peaceful town. Yes. So the NAACP has done a good job at keeping the peace. Mm-hmm. There still are many problems, even today. There are problems that exist.
Now, this seems to be a characteristic of the world today, though. There's just an increasing number of that. Let me ask another question, and then if you want to make some comments, I want you to do that, too, some observations. What about recreation? You talked about earlier about food and said this might be through church dinners, but what would there be recreation-wise? You were growing up. You were interested in church work. You said other boys and girls were playing ball or doing sports, something else. But what would there be for the black community recreation-wise? Was this through your lodges and clubs at church?
Yes, that's where the bulk of the adults got their social activities. The church back in those days were very well attended. It's hard now to have a night service no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. But when I was coming up, your night service was perhaps the best service there was because people were there.
This would be in the 1920s now, your 30s.
Yes, 20s, 30s, up to 40s, mm-hmm. all during the Depression years. The church was the gathering place. And it still is the black community today. It is the gathering place where blacks come together and talk about all of their problems. But we do have an active lodge. We have maybe two or three active lodges in and Tom. And, but as far as club-wise is concerned, there aren't any. As far as a recreational programs for the people today, there aren't any, as there weren't then. The adults got their joys out of going to church and in their lodges. The young people got theirs wherever they could find it, a ball game here, a softball here, a roller skating someplace here. That's the way they got there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing, no facilities. Mm-hmm. There has never been any facilities here for blacks entertainment. Of course, they say the whites have the youth center, but then it's way out. Mm-hmm. It's way out. Then your membership fees are prohibitive to the poor family.
Yes.
A few blacks can afford it,
mm-hmm.
and a few do have their memberships out there. But by and large, we need something on the square down there,
mm-hmm.
sponsored by the city, where the prices are nominal for mm-hmm. everybody. Then you might have something. Well, they could go down to Stanley Park to swim. See, but it was segregated.
Mm-hmm.
You could swim in the front half, but you couldn't swim in the back half. See, there was a big road down the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Blacks on this side of the road, whites on that side of the road, see. Yeah. As far as the rest is concerned that were here, you couldn't go. They wouldn't tell you no, but you could tell the attitude.
Yeah.
So the people, as a result, they didn't go to the India white restaurants. They get more patches now than they ever got. See, because these barriers are being broken down all over the world now. So. But back in those days, they didn't go to the restaurants.
I remember when I was a student here in the 30s, and I think about 35, one of your friends, you probably knew Dr. Cunningham.
Yes.
Who came here as a student from Canton.
Went on to be president of Morris Brown.
That's right, he went on to be president there. When he came over, I think we had maybe one or two blacks, and I'm not sure we had any in it at that particular time. I was in the YM, heading up the YMCA here, and I remember President McMaster called me in and said, some parents have written letters and there may be discrimination, and he said, no, I want you to do something. And as you said with the NAACP, sort of a low-key, we decided we'd meet him, we'd walk to chapel with him, we'd walk back from chapel with him, not the same fellow each time, but we had a schedule, and I don't think he ever realized this, but we tried to do this so that he wasn't an outcast, and of course he was a very fine person, and after a while, a great many in the student body accepted him, and there wasn't a problem, but at first, I recall that experience doing that.
Yes, we didn't have the access to things as we have today, back in those days. Yes.
Is there any other item that you'd like to point out? You've been identified and a student of the black community. Is there anything that you'd like to that we haven't covered briefly here?
Mm-hmm.
Anything pertains to your church work or something about the community, or you tell some interesting stories, maybe another experience or story that you'd like to share.
Of course, you know that our first doctor was Dr. K.T. Thompson. Dr. Cadius Thaddeus Thompson. And his first patient is still living, Mrs. Rux. Ruby Rux was his first patient in town. And his first office was down on Patterson Street. Do you remember Eagle Bakery?
Oh, yes.
And the big long building next to Eagle Bakery. Well, right next to Eagle Bakery was Dr. Thompson's office. That's where his office was there.
Now, what induced him to come, do you know, to settle to do practice here?
I forget now. I've got a conference with Mrs. Thompson to bring me up to date on this.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think some of his people, some relative, some acquaintance of his lived here.
Mm-hmm.
And he came and wanted to practice. Because some places he had been and they didn't want an African doctor.
Oh,
see, he's Native African.
Yes.
He's Native African. Cape Town? Cape Town, Southwest Africa, South Africa.
South Africa.
South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Cape Town, down to the bottom there. And I didn't know his story, how he got from Africa here, but I do know that he worked his way through Meharry's as a janitor there, and slept in the furnace room there, because he didn't have the money to pay his board. And he came to life, I believe, because of some people, some relatives of his, personal friends here, he came and settled. And of course, I think the thing that got him started were the red light houses. On all of Franklin Street, Jersey Street, Front Street. Nearly all of those houses were red light houses during the First War. Clear up in the 30s, up into those houses were prevalent. Up to 39, those houses were prevalent. And they had the occupants there had to have their medical examinations.
Yes.
And they didn't want to go to a white doctor. So this gave him a pretty good send-off because he's here in the community.
Mm-hmm.
They could come right from their houses, right on down there to him, and he could treat them.
Yeah.
So that got him a good start. Yes.
Well, he performed a very real service to the community here.
Yeah, everyone loved him.
Yes.
We are thinking about having a bicentennial reunion. One of the clubs that were organized in 1932, called the Booker T. Washington Club.
Hmm.
We, the old Y, before they got this new building.
Oh yes,
the little building. We I forget now the secretary there, who
was it Beermore?
Beermore. He got the group together. We organized a Booker T. Washington Club. Well, this club, they had high ideas, you know.
Yes.
We would play ball together, a lot of softball games. And we met there, I guess, about a year. We had a basketball team that beating everybody in the area. You're familiar with Harry Hamlin?
Oh yes.
Well, Harry Hamlin was a coach.
Our
basketball team back in the 30s, and he was a hustler too. I don't know where he got his money. Yes, he told me recently he got his money. I won't say.
All right.
And he would buy us uniforms. I didn't play basketball, see, but the other kids did.
Yeah.
He bought the kids uniforms. And the parents got to complaining about Harry taking the basketball team to Pittsburgh, all around, see. And Harry footing the bill. He was wondering about all of this, so they began to object to it. And Harry decides, well, if they're going to object to my sponsoring this basketball team, I'm going to take my suits. So he took his suits and left. That broke up the basketball. So what? J.D. Snodgrass and Robert Patterson, you and I were talking about 4 or 5 months ago. I said, well, let's call a reunion for the bicentennial. And so we've been trying to locate the boys and ask whether they'd come back to the Y. We have this reunion in the YMCA as a part of our bicentennial.
That's interesting.
So we're working on that.
Yeah. Can you think of some individuals in the black community who might not be living now, but you talked about Dr. Thompson and his personality, and can you think of others who, of course, Harry Hamlin is quite an individualist in his own right.
Yeah. I've been trying to get him to give me his life story, but he won't talk. He won't talk with me. So he says he has a whole lot of pictures and things in his suitcase.
He's painted, that's right. He's a primitive artist, and really they should be preserved. And I guess he's so fearful someone's going to take advantage of him that he will.
He says he's got a couple of suitcases full of information.
Yes.
But he won't do it. He comes past our house nearly every day. We have words or something.
Do you think of any women who were leaders or outstanding or any other men that you'd like to mention?
Well, there's Mrs. Terrell, who's been a great influence in our community.
That's Vanita?
All the Terrells have been very good in the community. Terrells and the Jacksons, Kirksies, and all of the Kirksies that have made a fine contribution to Lyons. Miss Jackson, related to the Terrells, was our first mayor. I mean, was our first councilman, our first black councilman.
Oh.
W.B. Jackson, back in the 30s, 32, I think, was our first black councilman. And then followed by Mr. Lima Starks. He was the second. Curvis is the third. Mr. Lima Starks.
Curvis has been more persistent.
He's been quite persistent.
Lasted longer.
That's right. And I think Curvis has made me